I'm very pleased to welcome to this, the last program in this series of Talking Books, Dr. James Corby. Just a few words about Dr. Corby. He obtained a BA Honours and MA in English from this university before going to the University of Essex to read for a further MA and a PhD dealing with particular interconnections between philosophy and literature. He's a lecturer in the Department of English here at the University of Malta, where he teaches courses in poetry, drama, literary theory, cultural criticism and aesthetics. His current research focuses on early German Romanticism, post-Romantic poetry, style in the work of Jean-Luc Nancy and Quentin Millesou. You're going to correct me on that, I'm sure. And the notion of poetic constellation. Welcome, Dr. Corby.
Thanks very much.
I'm sorry if I got the name of that guy wrong. I've been practicing it for 5 minutes before the program went on.
It's not an easy name.
It isn't. Today, I'm a really happy camper because we're going to talk about poetry and something I enjoy, have always enjoyed and continue to enjoy. I would like to sort of just, if I tell you what is poetry, I mean, it's impossible, forget it. Nobody's ever really defined it well. So we won't go down that road. But it's perhaps we need to have a little look about how you differentiate it from the normal book of words, the normal text, what its chief characteristics are. What would you say they were?
Well, I mean, to go back to the question that you raised and dismissed, rightly dismissed, because it is an unanswerable question, what is poetry? I think it's, whilst acknowledging that it's a question that can't really be answered, it's good to hold it open and to keep entertaining it now and again, because it's an important question and it's a pressing question, particularly if one believes, as I do, that poetry isn't something, there isn't some essential characteristic, some essential unchanging characteristic of poetry. Poetry does change. People find themselves attaching importance to different conceptions of poetry. For a lot of people, poetry is language that rhymes, which seems like a slightly simplistic view, but there are extremely important reasons why people think along those lines. Even if we're not talking about rhymes at the end of lines, poetry is full of rhythm and rhymes, and it has a peculiar music. It's able to compress a great deal into very few words. I think that's another important characteristic of poetry. So whilst I wouldn't want to dismiss the question, I wouldn't want to try to pin it down too much at this point either. I think it's a question that might continue to arise as we talk further.
Yes, one of the essays I read sort of in preparation a bit for this interview, one person said it's one of its main characteristics is its unwillingness to sit down and be quiet.
I think that's very true. We are, it's a bit of a broad statement, but I think there's a general truth in it. We are very good at processing information in this day and age. We're increasingly good at it. We are very efficient. You know, we prize that sort of efficiency. You know, we get information via email, text messages, the internet. And I think there's a danger in that kind of intellectual consumerism, insofar as I think Simon Critchley put it very nicely. If we go too far down that route, the outside world starts to become oppressive and the self depressive. We're just simply passive receivers of what's being given to us. And poetry sort of throws a spanner in the works. You know, if we're just processing machines, then poetry causes us to slow down, perhaps to stop, to tarry, to linger, as all art does, I think. I think that's very, very important. It allows us to push back against the world a little bit, to open up a sort of a space of reflection and a space in which one might even dare to reimagine the world. I think that's quite important.
One of the things that always amuses me or interests me when I look at different bits and pieces of poetry from different poets, different eras, is the spatial element of it. The idea when I look at the sonnet on the page and it's perfect sort of shape, or I think it was it E. Cummings who wrote diamond-shaped poetry. Perhaps I'm getting the poet wrong. But that spatial element, which I really find fascinating and makes it so artistic, really.
Yes, I mean, some of the metaphysical poets played with acrostics and, you know, making images out of the words on a page. But I think, I mean, yes, poetry is to do with the fundamentals. It's to do with space and time. You know, it's something, you know, this is something Heidegger talks about a great deal, about poetry, about language being ultimately a material artifact. You know, there are words on a page. Similarly with art, there's oil on a canvas. You know, it's something physical. It is a thing. But it's a thing that's transfigured and transformed in our reception of that thing. So if we're to experience poetry, it involves us sort of stepping up to the mark, as it were, and engaging with it. And that has a lot to do with its space, in the way it's set out, in the way it reorders the world, the space in which we live, and in the way it makes us reassess time. I think that's an important point.
When I asked you what poets you'd like to talk about, the ones you mentioned were Yeats and Larkin. Mm. And then you mentioned a poet who I didn't have any familiarity with at all, because it's a contemporary poet, John Burnside. What made you go for those names rather than any other?
Well, funnily enough, I think it comes back to that question, what is poetry? You know, Wallace Stevens urges us to find a poetry of our time, something fitting for our time, not a relic, not a souvenir of what's past. And I think those, by looking at those poets, you can get a sense of a certain trajectory in poetry. I think the 20th century was still very much enthralled to Romanticism and to Romantic aesthetics, despite the sort of avowed rejection of Romanticism by people like Eliot and Pound. I think they were fundamentally writing in the Romantic mold. Yeats is extremely interesting because, well, for any number of reasons, really, but one of them, chiefly, is the amount of time that he was writing, the amount of time that he was publishing as a poet, and getting better. You know, he was writing poetry right until his death, until in 1939, and he published his first poems in 1888, you know, when Tennyson was poet laureate. So this is a time of enormous change, both cultural and specifically in terms of poetry. And as I say, he wasn't weakening as a poet. He wasn't a Wordsworth. You know, he was getting stronger and stronger as he continued. And he encapsulates that arc, the wonderful trajectory of his career, encapsulates a certain movement that I think can be witnessed more broadly in British poetry of that time, which is a move from Romanticism, sort of high Romanticism, very florid language in his early work, through to a more modernist sensibility, although he was never really a modernist for a number of reasons. But he still, at this time, he very passionately believes in the power of poetry, which I think is ultimately romantic. You know, the idea that Romanticism can take you beyond somewhere. You know, there's a very persuasive argument, I think, which positions Romanticism as a reaction to a kind of epistemological failure. You know, we can't know everything through science and through philosophy, so perhaps art can, you know, shine light in those opaque areas. And so you get Romanticism with all sorts of attendant ideas of transcendence and so on. And Yeats still very much believes that. You see it in his middle period work, the wonderful book of poetry called The Tower, where he writes these long apocalyptic sequence poems that really are on a par with something like The Wasteland. You know, he was, and of course the link there was probably Ezra Pound. Ezra Pound and Yeats spent a number of winters living together in a cottage in the south of England called Stone Cottage. And of course, Ezra Pound was Il Miglio Fabbro of the Wasteland. And so he's writing in this very, very modernist way, still subscribing to a kind of romantic idea of the power of poetry. And then after that, as the 20s and the 30s wear on, you see him starting to distance himself from that belief. It's almost a loss of faith in poetry and in what poetry can do. Of course, out of that loss of faith, he writes wonderful poetry. There's an interesting irony there, that the moment he loses faith in poetry are usually moments where there's this resurgence of his poetic power. But generally, it does mark a decline. You know, Circus Animals' Desertion, he famously says, "We must lie down where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart." The ladders, or stilts, as he calls them in another poem, Malachi Stiltjack, are the tropes, the metaphors, and so on, that allow him to rise above the common everyday world and produce this wonderful poetry. He thinks that wonderful world of poetry, he comes to think that this wonderful world of poetry is somewhat illusory. In another late poem, he says, "What do we know but that we face one another in this place?" You know, there's this sort of hard, contracted empiricism that starts emerging.
The fact that he's an Irish poet, because before you referred to him as a British poet, and in a way that's right, because he spent years in the UK, I would have thought about him as an Irish poet. How much do you feel his being Irish actually at the end of the day was sort of influential on how he developed as a poet?
It was extremely important in his early days. He was, of course, caught up in the movement that we refer to as the Celtic Twilight, this attempt to try to reinstate a kind of national pride, particularly after the Parnell affair caused great scandal, Ireland's leading politician being caught in an extramarital affair. And to that end, of course, he founded with Lady Gregory the Abbey Theatre, an attempt to try to cultivate a distinctly Irish dramatic art form. But he gets he's a snob. I mean, Yeats is a terrible snob, and he becomes very, very frustrated with what he calls theatre business and the management of men. There's a poem called "The Fascination with What's Difficult." And so he is embroiled in that. He's entangled in Irish politics, but ultimately he sees himself as possessing a sort of pan-European identity in terms of his aesthetic outlook.
But he did feel homesick, didn't he, for Ireland, when as most Irishmen in self-imposed or forced exile do, tend to look back.
Yes,
with perhaps pink lensed spectacles on their homeland.
That's absolutely true, and out of that came poems like "The Lake Isle of Innisfree." I think what you point to there, the idea of exile, the idea of being cut off or at a remove from what one wants to possess, is an extremely important structural feature of Yeats's poetry, but poetry of the 20th century, really. You could link it with the idea of transcendence, wanting to transcend through poetry, being caught between almost incapacity and demand. There is a demand, a call that one wants to answer, and yet one never quite lives up to that call. That can be cast in aesthetic terms, it can be cast in religious terms, and it can be discarded on those terms. But it's something that you see replayed in the poetry of the 20th century, I think, this idea of being driven by desire and yet not being able to fulfill that desire.
And how do you feel Larkin follows on, if he follows on at all, from that kind of build-up?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Larkin emerged or was categorized as one of the movement poets, which was a bit of a ragbag assemblage of post-war poets. There was an article in The Spectator by J.D. Scott, and he was talking about this group of poets that seemed to share certain characteristics, and he didn't know what to call them, so he just called this movement the movement. One of the main theorists, main protagonists in that group, and also a poet, of course, Donald Davey, he said that what poetry needed at that time was a self-imposed loss of nerve. So there's a sort of a move away from some of the grander claims of poetry. And that accords very nicely with the trajectory of Yeats. You know, you see Yeats suffering a kind of loss of faith in poetry, and then 10, 15 years afterwards, when the movement poets emerge, you see this picked up almost as a credo. This is something that we must do. We must renounce the sort of quasi religious aspects of poetry and turn to the more empirical, the ordinary, the everyday. In that regard, Larkin and the movement poets are not only anti-romantic, but they're also anti-modernist as well. And I think their peculiar insight was to see the similarities between modernist poets like Eliot and romantic poets. They take up, of course, the mantle of somebody like T. E. Hume, who thought that romanticism, what he called romanticism, spilt religion. Quite a provocative way of putting it, but I think carries a certain truthful force. And so they want to, you know, they move away from the idea of transcendence. They disavow that. This quest, this longing, this desire, whether it's for home or whether it's for some higher realm, they give that up as a sort of bad business. And so they seemingly pick up, you know, in a post-war way where Yeats left off, almost affirming what Auden said about Yeats. You know, Auden says, "You were silly like us," addressing Yeats. He said, "Poetry makes nothing happen." And it's, you get a sense that that's the realization that Yeats was coming to, and that's the idea that the movement poets take on board. What's interesting about Larkin, of course, is that that might be true for early collections of poetry, like the tellingly named The Less Deceived. But as he goes on, you get this movement away from the sort of typical cynicism and Little Englandism of Larkin, towards a kind of desire, re-emergence of that desire for some kind of transcendence that pokes its head through in poems like High Windows, where you get two or three stanzas of conversational verse, quite rough, actually, in the language. He swears in the poem and so on. And then in the final stanza, you get a sort of elliptical feat of compression, of concision, in which he gestures towards something higher, something beyond, and suddenly this mask of cynicism slips, and you get this emergence of this, again, this structural, this familiar structural trope of being caught between the demand, the call for something higher, and the inability to reach it. So I think Larkin is useful in that regard. You see this element in Yeats extended, but also you see a kind of movement back from it, a slight movement back from it.
Do you think that is because it's something that happens as you grow older? Perhaps as he grew older, he was perhaps looking for, you start looking at life in a different way, perhaps?
It could well be. I mean, Larkin, I'm not sure whether Larkin was ever young, actually. but one thing is for sure, he resented youth. The older he got, the more he resented youth. He felt as though he missed out on all of the emergence of youth culture in the 50s and 60s. He felt he was just a little bit too old for that.
What about the today's poets, and you mentioned to me this John Burnside from the University of St. Andrews. Do you feel that these people are now continuing along that road in some different way? Have they branched off somewhere along the line?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we can take a couple of steps back, perhaps, just to identify the real landmarks on the poetry scene of the 20th century, I think you really have to acknowledge Yeats as standing over all 20th century British poetry. I say British, but obviously we could talk for hours about how complicated it is to identify Yeats as a British poet, or Eliot as an English poet, or Auden as an American poet. And then directly following him, I suppose, would be people like Auden and Eliot. Eliot, an American who became an Englishman. Auden, an Englishman who became an American. And then with the movement, poets tap into a different strain. They bypass this main current of poetry in English and rediscover early poetry of the 20th century, poetry that wasn't modernist and so was overlooked, it was bypassed. But it's something that's very important to Larkin in particular. Larkin complains about, in the preface to an early book of poetry but written a lot later, a preface to Northship, but this particular preface was published in 1966, I think. He talks about being under the sway of Yeats, but finding Yeats to be Yeats's music. He was in love with Yeats's music, but he found it to be, in his words, as pervasive as garlic. He wanted to try to escape it. He wanted to try to distance himself from that. And he did so by reading poetry that preceded the modernist innovations in Britain. And so picked up this other strain of poetry. Now, somebody like Burnside probably follows more from Eliot's trajectory. And I suppose you'd probably, if you're picking up the big names, you'd probably say Eliot, Geoffrey Hill, and then chart a path to Burnside. But Eliot too, I mean, we talk about this loss of nerve. You see that in Eliot as well. It's not quite as pronounced. Eliot gets slightly more defensive as he gets older as a writer. But of course, famously, The Wasteland begins with April is the cruelest month. There is something very strong, declaratory, something almost Vatic about that. And then the first line of the first poem of the four quartets, he says, time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future. And I think that perhaps says everything. There's this loss of nerve. And you get a sense of that, we could talk about it in more depth, as you read through the four quartets. So there is a kind of stepping back still in Burnside's work, but there is a more ready acknowledgement of that which might be said to transcend the here and now. But it's these obscure, opaque things that can't be pinned down so easily tend to be located within the human world in Burnside's work, which I think is quite distinct from Eliot's earlier work and quite distinct from some of Geoffrey Hill's work too.
As a lecturer, obviously in poetry and various aspects of literature, you have students in front of you who have decided to dedicate their university years to words.
Yes.
So perhaps you find an audience that is keen on poetry already, but do you find that the young audience of 2009 is receptive to poetry?
Not initially. Not when they come to us in the first year. It's something, a love of poetry is something I think you have to nurture, because it is strange, it is difficult, it does throw a spanner in the works. You can't understand it as easily as you can, I'm speaking very broadly, but as easily as you can a novel. You can read novels fairly quickly. Obviously, the more poetic they are, the more slowly you have to work through them. But poetry demands a certain patience. And I think a mistake students make is to read poetry quietly, just to read it, hearing the voice in their heads. Poetry demands to be read out loud. You need to be able to hear your voice. You need to be able to hear the music that the poetry brings out in your voice. And also, I think it's very important not to read just simply one poem, two poems of a poet, but to really immerse yourself in the poets over, really. If you can get the collected works, if you can get the letters, if you can get a good biography, a critical biography, I think that's very important. Because the poet, to read poetry, to immerse yourself in poetry, is to inhabit another subjectivity. It's to inhabit another self. It's to see the world recast through somebody else's eyes. That's where the power of poetry lies, I think. And you can't do that just by dipping into one or two poems. You need to pick up all of the linguistic ticks and nuances of the poet. You need to be able to think and see and conceive the world as the poet does. And you can only do that through a certain immersion in poetry. But you really, in a three-year undergraduate course, that's quite a tall order. And you tend to find students who develop a love of poetry do that for maybe one or two poets. One or two poets they'll latch on to, and they'll keep reading them after their course is finished. I think that's the way to do it. It's certainly the way that I got into poetry when I was a student at this university with some very, very good lecturers, people I work alongside with now. When I was taught Yeats by Professor Peter Vassallo, he was able to paint very broadly Yeats's worldview and then take you in, zoom in to the actual texts themselves to show how this fits into that worldview. And it allowed me as a student to get a sense of Yeats's aspect on the world. And I think if you can, as a lecturer, encourage students to do that, to immerse themselves in works of poetry, then they will have the same kind of result. You know, they will take on this other view of the world. And that's an extremely valuable lesson, I think.
Well, Dr. James Corby, thank you very, very much for coming in to talk to us today about poetry. And I think your students are very lucky.
Yeah, thank you.
That was the last programme in the series Talking Books. From next week, I shall be presenting another edition of Research Matters. Thank you so much for listening. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.